This is Linda Olsen-Osterlund for KBOO Radio, and thanks for listening. My guest today is Chuck Sudetic. He's a former reporter for the New York Times from 1990 to 1995 on the breakup of Yugoslavia and the transition from communism in other Balkan countries. He's also an author of his own book, Blood and Vengeance, and many articles in The Economist, Atlantic Monthly, Mother Jones, etc. He is with us today because he's talking about a book that he is the co-author of called Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. Thanks for joining us here at KBOO.
It's nice to be here, Linda.
And your co-author is Carla Del Ponte, and she was the chief prosecutor of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia from 1999 to 2007, but also the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda from 1999 to 2003. She's not allowed to speak about this book currently. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, I can tell you that I frankly would rather have her speaking about it than me, because she comes at this with a great deal of passion and a great deal of energy. She is now the ambassador of Switzerland to Buenos Aires in Argentina. And because of her position and some of the revelations that were made in Madam Prosecutor, the Swiss government put a gag order on her. This has gone on for almost a year now, and frankly, I don't see the point in it anymore, because the things that we raised in the book that have specifically to do with Kosovo and some crimes alleged to have been committed down there have pretty much been borne out. And as time has gone by, they've become much more firm. We knew a lot of this anyway. But the Swiss government made its decision, and it continues to stick by its gag order, and that's a reality we have to live with.
And the revelations you're talking about were the allegation that among men taken across the border to be killed, there were those that were kept alive and kept well so that they could be harvested for their organs.
That's right. The crime that was looked into by the International Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia was the kidnapping of approximately 100 to 300 Serbs from Kosovo after the armed conflict. So these people were picked up on the streets by Albanians and members of the Kosovo Liberation Army. They were taken across the border into Albania against their will, and they've since disappeared. No graves have been found in Kosovo, and it's been a working assumption from the inside the UN ever since that those people were killed in Albania. And what the tribunal came upon was, through another UN agency, the United Nations mission in Kosovo, was a tip that was based upon some journalists that some of these people had been killed by an organized crime ring, perhaps several dozen people, by an organized crime ring that had subsequently sold their organs. And what happened subsequent to the tip was the ICTY, the Yugoslavia Tribunal, and the UN mission in Kosovo went with an Albanian prosecutor to a house where this activity was said to have taken place. It was a peasant house far from any hospital. And what they found was medical paraphernalia on the ground strewn around outside, and inside the house, in places where the sources pinpointed that this activity had taken place, they sprayed with luminol after having been told that there was no blood anywhere to be found. And the place lit up. Now, what luminol is this CSI kind of spray you put on a wall, and you can tell that there's been any kind of hemoglobin sprayed or spilled there. And the reason that we got into this in the book was, first, it's to show the kind of crimes we're talking about, first. Secondly, the kind of tips that you get. Third, the kind of things that you don't have the ability to investigate at that time. The ICTY didn't have jurisdiction of these crimes because they had taken place, they had been alleged to have taken place after the armed conflict in Kosovo had ended. So the War Crimes Tribunal didn't have jurisdiction. And second, it was up against a very, very strict time constraint for opening further investigations. So the ICTY couldn't investigate, but the reason we brought it out in the book was because we felt that enough time had passed and there had been no action taken either by Albanian authorities in Albania or Albanian authorities in Kosovo or the United Nations mission in Kosovo to investigate this. So we wanted to stir an investigation, and we were able to do so.
Well, I think it's very important that these kind of allegations come out. Can you sort of set the scene of when was the beginning of these war crimes and what were the biggest incidents that needed to be looked into and what did it take to investigate these?
Well, the first thing you have to realize is that the United Nations Criminal Tribunal for Yugoslavia was created by the UN Security Council at a time when there was a major offensive going on against a place called Srebrenica that the members of the Security Council did not want to vote to intervene to stop. So it was kind of a fallback position to create deterrence going forward against war crimes. Unfortunately, the deterrence wasn't sufficient to stop a massacre occurring 2 years later in the same place, Srebrenica. What Madame Del Ponte was involved in as the prosecutor, what her job was to liaise with the governments of the countries that came into being after the breakup of Yugoslavia, those being Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia, and to extract from them cooperation for prosecution of persons suspected of war crimes, evidence, the arrest of people who were indicted, and protection of witnesses. Her legal authority was very limited. She had less legal authority to impose her will upon those countries than, for example, a criminal court in Portland that's trying the drug dealer from down the street. She couldn't issue subpoenas and have them enforced. She couldn't issue indictments and have them enforced. And she couldn't demand or ensure protection of witnesses. What she had to do was rely upon voluntary assistance.
She also relied a lot upon her own will, her own determination. She had sort of made her chops against the Sicilian mafia when she was a prosecutor in the financial area of Switzerland, stopping the money laundering of mafia money through Switzerland's financial institutions. And she had her life threatened. Her boss was murdered by the mafia. He was killed in a car bomb. Her own house was set to explode. And during the time that she was on these tribunals, really it was her strength of personality, though I sometimes think that may have been offensive to people. When she writes about herself, you can tell she's a bull. She doesn't back down, and she goes straight to the point and is often very direct and confrontive. But she clearly sees that as her main role, that it took her belief in her right to bring these charges and to have the fugitives be brought to justice.
That's precisely correct. And the results showed. Dozens of people who were indicted were brought to the tribunals in Yugoslavia and the Rwanda tribunal as well, through the assertion of her will. People who have criticized Madame Del Ponte over the years have essentially been diplomats who are involved in a much different game. Madame Del Ponte comes into this as a prosecutor. She's collecting evidence. She's drawing up indictments. Those indictments have to be approved by a judge from the tribunal before they can be served. And once they are, she did not stop to lower her guard and make, unwarranted compromises at any time. And it proved to be effective. There's been a softer approach taken. And mind you, she at the end of her mandate, after 8 years in the Yugoslavia tribunal, she had only four individuals who were left at large. One of them was pretty much immaterial. He can be tried at home. The other three, Goran Hadžić, Ratko Mladić, and Radovan Karadžić, are pretty high-ranking people. And Karadžić was brought into custody not long afterwards. This to say that they've tried a softer approach since Del Ponte left, and it's not been effective in bringing in the other three.
Well, this Mladic that she tried to the very end. She pressured in every way she knew possible, including the most effective pressure, which was always the United States and the European Union threatening not to give economic aid. And so she relied on utilizing the pressure of those two countries. But there in Serbia, for example, there are still criminals. I saw a whole hour and a half video on the Srebrenica massacres, and Mladic is running around with big gestures and smiles. He is certainly a man you would want to bring down. So can you talk a little bit about Mladic, the man who did get away?
In mid-July 1995, approximately 7,000 to 8,000 Bosnian Muslims were taken captive by the Bosnian Serb army under the command of Ratko Mladic. On the morning of July 12th, thereabouts, Mladic said that the people who were taken prisoner were going to be killed. This was evidence that's been adduced in trials at the tribunal beforehand. It's the evidence is there for anybody to read. All they have to do is look at it. And you had the summary executions of thousands and thousands of young men taken prisoners, had their arms and bound, and were summarily shot. Subsequent to that, there was a great denial going on, and then, you know, sure enough, they found the mass graves. And for years and years and years, Ratko Mladic enjoyed the protection of both the Serbian government and, as he still does today, the military or elements of the military of Serbia, and he's protected there in a way that's it's frustrated the efforts of people like Madame Del Ponte for her 8 years, but he was indicted originally in 1996, so the man has been at large for 13 years.
And this kind of massacre that took place there, it even shocked the people of Serbia. It took, I believe, a video of some of the troops who were called scorpions that were bringing the men to execution. That video aired late in Ms. Del Ponte's reign as chief prosecutor, but was finally got into the public's eye, and they were able to see that indeed their leaders had done these things that they were accused of.
Yes, exactly. It took graphic evidence, a video that the shooters, that the executioners had taken of themselves shooting the prisoners. Imagine how brazen that is. These were teenagers. And then showing that to your friends on video. That's what got out. And finally, when it was brought into the public domain, all of a sudden the denial could no longer be maintained. And action had to be taken to, quote-unquote, clean up their act in terms of saying, oh yes, well, this did happen. There were some mea culpas given, and there was a little bit more cooperation in terms of the arrests of some lower ranking people who were involved in giving orders. Mind you, that Del Ponte's job was not to arrest the guys who did the shooting on the ground. Her job was to go after the high ranking guys, the ones who gave the orders, the high ranking managers of this thing. But even with that revelation, it still wasn't enough and hasn't been enough to bring General Mladic to justice. And this is not persecution. He's going to stand trial and face facts and face his accusers, and people are going to step forward and give testimony against him, and it's going to be up to judges to decide whether he's guilty or innocent. But if you don't put him on trial, you're leaving yourself open to either allowing impunity to continue, which will only mean more Holocausts, more Cambodias, more Rwandas, more Bosnias, or you're going to allow for vengeance to rear its ugly head.
I'm speaking with Chuck Sudetic, co-author of Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. And you just mentioned impunity again, Mr. Sudetic, and I noticed that the main thing that Carla Del Ponte was able to rely on was the pressure brought by larger countries, countries with very real power, economic power, the United States in particular, and also the European Union as a group. And that when she pressured them to put economic pressure on Serbia, and the other nations involved. She was criticized by Kofi Annan, then the head of the United Nations. She later points out that it was, in fact, that very pressure that was successful. I think there came a point when Serbia very much wanted to take part in a certain meeting that was a donors meeting where there was going to be the hope for economic aid. And it was at the very last minute that they began to arrest and turn over a large number of those indicted that the criminal court had been seeking for a long time.
Reading Madam Prosecutor, what you see is first and foremost that the guy, it's clear from the text, who deserves the lion's share of credit for applying the really early pressure to get Milosevic arrested and handed over, which really opened the floodgates for the arrest of further people from Serbia, was Secretary of State Colin Powell. He stood up when, in the first few months of the Bush administration, when Del Ponte wasn't at all sure how the U.S. would come down on a war crimes tribunal, which way would the Bush administration swing. And now, mind you, the Bush administration's positions on war crimes tribunals isn't exactly the most friendly. But Powell stood four square beside her and said, no, we have the discretion to certify whether there's cooperation with the tribunal before we allow there to be the release of financial assistance to Serbia. And it was largely through that leverage that they were able to produce the arrest and the handover of Milosevic. And as I said, that opened the gate for a lot of other arrests and handovers.
And later when they wanted, I believe it was Serbia, wanted particularly to get into the Partnership for Peace, which is the beginning entry stage to getting into NATO, that was an initiative of the United States, that once again, it was their desire to become part of that that forced them to turn over more. That until then, these governments where these atrocities had taken place really were just blowing off the international community over and over again. She has a phrase, she calls it Muro di Goma, is that right?
Muro di Goma. It's an Italian phrase. What Muro di Goma means is if you're Del Ponte, you walk into an office of a foreign minister and you say, we need this and this and this, and we want to do justice in this situation. We want to get impunity erased from the equation that international or that leaders in local areas where war crimes have been committed count on to continue what they've done, that you get back a smile and they say, yes, we'll do it. And then nothing happens.
Lots of assurances, no action.
Lots of assurances and no action. And Del Ponte had very little in her war chest, really, to pull on, except her personal will and the ability to play one of these groups, the EU or the UN or the United States, off against the other. You pointed out already that when she effectively secured Milosevic's arrest and handover, she was given a letter by the Secretary General of the United Nations saying, desist from doing this. The one thing that worked, if you had removed that from her, you know, the leverage that she was able to apply, then the question then becomes, do you want a war crimes tribunal or not? And that's a very fundamental question that had to be answered. And in the end, she basically disregarded what the UN Secretary General told her, and went on applying the same kind of pressure over and over again, and with great effect.
Now, Milosevic, who was really the architect, along with a man named Tudjman, of some of the original, he was, Tudjman, is that how you say it? He was the
Franjo
head.
Franjo Tudjman was the president of Croatia.
And they actually conspired together as enemies to destroy Bosnia and Herzegovina, which was sort of between the two of them, sort of, because Croatia goes up and around that. But to actually, in 91, go in and destroy it and tear it apart along ethnic lines. But they didn't do this because of loyalty to their ethnicities. They did it more for powers and for resources.
It's the two leaders, and this is based upon nothing that I learned at the tribunal and everything that I learned as a correspondent. On Milosevic's side, it was basically a power play. He was interested in maintaining his control over as much of the former Yugoslavia as he could from the time he took over in the late 1980s until the time he fell in the late 90s. The Tudjman, on the other hand, was a the dyed-in-the-wool nationalist who wanted to create an enlarged Croatia that would have a part of Bosnia and Herzegovina's territory attached to it. And where Milosevic and Tudjman were at loggerheads over the control of certain areas of Croatia that had large numbers of Serbs, they lined up with one another on a breakup of the Republic of Bosnia and Herzegovina and the distribution of its territory between two or three different states.
Ms. Del Ponte says very clearly that she doesn't believe that it's either cultures or historical animosities that create genocide, but that it's individuals, people who utilize those kinds of differences for their own needs and who incite their fellow man to go against other men on purpose for their own benefit. Was that your opinion by the end of this?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, when you see the kind of presentation of the world that's made to people about the other, for example, when the media in Serbia talked about Croats and presented them as basically revived fascists from the Second World War, or when Croats presented Serbs or Muslims, or the Serbs presented Muslims as something that was a threat to an imminent genocide against them. Basically, what they were doing was creating a kind of frenzy, a frenzy of fear. And fear resides right next to hatred. And when you put those two together, people are willing to go out and do anything with the excuse that they're protecting themselves.
Let's carry this over to Rwanda anyway. I saw real parallels, though. Rwanda is a very different situation, and many, many more people were killed. As many as 800,000 were killed in the genocide that she was responsible for investigating and bringing to trial. And it seemed to me that there were certain parallels that were striking. One was that leaders on both sides attempted to benefit from this and utilize the animosities that had been historical and going on for a while. And it even appears as if they relied on each other in the sense that one side could count on the other's response to be a certain way so that they could go ahead with their actions. Can you talk a little bit about the Rwanda tribunals and the parallels to the Yugoslavian tribunal?
The parallels are very difficult, but I can talk about what Del Ponte attempted to do in wielding her authority to investigate and present indictments. What her job was to go after the highest ranking people responsible for war crimes on all sides of a given conflict. Now, in Rwanda, primarily, you had 800,000 people massacred within weeks, and primarily her job was to go after the leadership of the Hutu who had carried this out, who had given the orders, who had whipped up their people into a frenzy to go out and machete their neighbors. That said, however, the tit-for-tat violence that had been going on and ratcheting up in Rwanda over the period preceding the genocide was unmistakable. And one of the things that a war crimes tribunal must do in order to establish any credibility at all is, as I said, to try individuals on all sides. Del Ponte wanted to investigate very credible reports of the killings of many thousands of Hutus by Tutsis that went on both during that genocide and afterwards. And what happened when she attempted to do that was basically what I describe in the book as the Muro di Goma. The Kagame people didn't want to have anything to do with it. They were opposed. They blocked. They tapped the phones of the tribunal. They did everything to thwart the investigation. And then finally, when it was announced that Del Ponte wanted to have just one case, and that was the case of the murders of about 10 Catholic clerics, including a few bishops, who had been taken prisoner and held for a few days and then killed. So there wasn't like an immediate killing that could have been done in a rage of passion. When she wanted to investigate that, the entire effort was blocked by the government of Rwanda, and then efforts were undertaken by Rwanda and with some support from the U.S. and Great Britain to remove Del Ponte as the prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And since then, there has been no more talk about presenting indictments against Tutsis.
What were the reasons that she was not able to bring that support from the United States and the EU to back her up in Rwanda?
It got into the problem of diplomacy and how you want to proceed in that part of Africa, which is a tinderbox. Remember, Linda, since 1994, there's been a war going on there just off of Rwanda's border that has caused more deaths than any other conflict since World War II.
We're talking about the Congo.
Numbers in the millions, and it's in eastern Congo. Largely started as a spinoff from the Rwanda genocide. So people looking to create stability in that part of the country and trying to nail that stability to the regime of Kagame in Rwanda don't want to see him shaken up by any indictments. And so they had that interest in seeing that it wasn't undertaken.
Carla Del Ponte talks about wanting to end impunity, end the sense that leaders, powerful leaders, can order the destruction of thousands of people's lives with impunity. When I look at the International Criminal Court now, one of the limitations that it has is that it can only prosecute those who are either signatories or who committed crimes in nations that are signatories. And nations like the United States, who have withdrawn their signatures from that international war crimes tribunal. So we're no longer a signatory to that. So, and I noticed that any of the countries we're operating in militarily are no longer signatories to that. That presents a particular set of problems, doesn't it?
It sure does. But you know, Linda, I don't think you want to make the best the enemy of the good in this situation.
Say that again.
You don't want to make the best the enemy of the good. In other words, what I'm saying is you can't expect to engineer a perfect international criminal court that's going to gather when in a world where there are so many interests that are at loggerheads. There's no way to engineer something that complicated and that intrusive upon diplomacy, intelligence, military decision-making, these things, all at once. But, you know, time goes by and things change. You know, it took a long time for the Genocide Pact treaty to be ratified. You know, these are things that need patience, time, and I think most of all, and I think this is, you know, one of the lessons of Madam Prosecutor, an assertion of will. Because if you allow those leaders who are involved in the blood diamonds, who are involved in the metal trade from eastern Congo, who are leaders of extremist political organizations like the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, if you allow them the impunity, they'll continue to take it. And these days, with the weapons that are available very cheaply, it will only make life worse for everybody. This is one thing that can be done to insert a deterrent factor in the decision-making equations that these leaders really make. They do figure these things, the risks and returns, in their decision-making, and maybe draw them back from committing the really big crimes.
Well, Chuck Sudetic, on that note, I think that we can complete our interview. I wanted to thank you so much for joining us here today at KBOO. You are the co-author of the book, Madam Prosecutor, Confrontations with Humanity's Worst Criminals and the Culture of Impunity. You're also the author of a book called Blood and Vengeance that came out in 1998 about the wars that went on there in the Balkans. And I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Linda. It was my pleasure.